The following Dharma talk was given at Boundless Way Zen Temple in Worcester, Massachusetts. Case 23 from the Gateless Gate. The sixth ancestor was pursued by Ming the head monk as far as Dayu Peak. The monk, seeing Ming coming, laid the robe and bowl on a rock, and said, "This robe represents the Dharma. There should be no fighting over it. You may take it back with you." Ming tried to lift it up, but it was as immovable as a mountain. Shivering and trembling, he said, "I came for the Dharma, not for the robe. I beg you, lay brother, please open the way for me." The teacher said, "Don't think good, don't think evil. At this very moment, what is the original face of Ming, the head monk?" In that instant, Ming had great satori. Sweat ran from his entire body. In tears, he made his bows, saying, "Beside these secret words and secret meanings, is there anything of further significance?" The teacher said, "What I have just conveyed to you is not secret. If you reflect on your own face, whatever is secret will be right there with you." Ming said, "Though I practiced at Huangmei with the assembly, I could not truly realize my original face. Now, thanks to your pointed instruction, I am like someone who drinks water and knows personally whether it is cold or warm. Lay brother, you are now my teacher." The teacher said, "If you can see that, if you can say that, then let us both call Huangmei our teacher. Maintain your realization carefully." And Wu Men's comment on this case goes like this: "It must be said that the sixth ancestor forgets himself completely in taking action here. He's like a kindly grandmother who peels a fresh lychee, removes the seed, and puts it into your mouth. Then you only need to swallow it down." And Wu Men's verse goes, "It can't be described. It can't be pictured. It can't be praised enough. Stop groping for it. The original face has nowhere to hide. When the world is destroyed, it is not destroyed." So, our second day of Sesshin, we're moving into maybe a little bit of new territory, or maybe really familiar old territory. All kinds of things coming up, being examined, looked into, really getting to know intimately this person that you call yourself, that we call ourselves. How we react and respond to stressing things and hurting things and sleepy things and forgetting things. The cleanness of a Zen Sesshin is such that these things really come forward and reveal themselves to us in ways that they don't usually in our so-called ordinary life. There's time and space to really examine what we really want from life and what might be getting in our way. I love the line in Wu Men's comment about comparing Hui Neng to an old grandmother who peels the lychee nut for you and takes out the seed and puts it in your mouth. In a way, we might say that all the teachings are doing that constantly, and I don't just mean the teachings that are coming from the teachers, in quotes, but the teachers in the most general sense, the teachings of the traffic, the teachings of the coolness of the air, the teachings of the pain and distress in our bodies and hearts and minds, and the teachings in the joy that can be experienced when we stop trying to create a kind of logical scenario for our lives. This logical scenario, which we borrow from all kinds of places, even from these kinds of Dharma talks, quotations and readings and all kinds of ideas, they fill our minds. But as Katagiri Roshi, Dainin Katagiri Roshi, called the title of one of his books, You Have to Say Something. And I appreciate that as a teacher, because I always go into these talks, whether they're our weekly talks or Sesshin talks, not really knowing what's going to come out. Instead, my process is to saturate myself with the Dharma, not just through sitting, but through absorbing everything that's arising in my own body, mind, and heart, and noticing my reactivity to some things and my receiving joyfully others. It's almost like the world is constantly peeling lychee nuts and popping them into my mouth. And sometimes I spit them out, and sometimes I appreciate them, and sometimes I don't even know they're there. Because as Wu Man says about Hui Neng here, and if you can imagine, really go deeply into this lovely metaphor. If you've ever had a lychee nut, then you'll know this. And if you haven't, you can imagine it's a small, sweet piece of fruit that does have a big pit in it, like a date. And so we have dates on our wonderful snack table. And you can imagine just someone popping that into your mouth and it melts. And you don't even need to do anything. When I used to work at the mindfulness clinic years ago, we had a practice which we called the raisin exercise, or the raisin practice. We amended it in later years. And you took a raisin and let all your senses explore the reality of that raisin. You smelled it and looked at it and even put it up to your ear and crinkled it and rubbed it along your lips and all these different reactions in the body. And then when we finally put it in our mouth, we instructed people not to chew it. And then there, even as I'm talking about it, I'm salivating a little bit. And what happens to the body in that moment is the strong desire to get to it, the strong desire to chew it up and swallow it down. And luckily we had a lot of raisins, because people would do that before they heard the instructions. I remember one guy who told me that he had been to a former class and he had left in shame because he'd eaten the raisin before the teacher said, and don't chew it. He had just been chomping on it and he thought, oh no, and he was so ashamed. And I said, I'm really glad you came back to experience it again. And also to open to whatever feelings might have arisen around that one little tiny shriveled piece of fruit that caused such a strong reaction. This is how we human beings are. Little things really get us, and little things entertain us, and little things are ignored. So one of the things that would happen when we were invited to take one bite is that the hard shell of the raisin, probably don't even think that raisins have hard shells, would split open, and inside there was this soft sweetness, amazingly sweet. Not what we think of as the way raisins taste, because we're always on the trying to chew them up fast and get them down. And this was always a profound experience for me, whether I was following someone else's instructions or giving the instructions. That moment of the bursting forth of the taste and the sweetness of the raisin, the moment of bursting forth for Ming, the head monk, when Wei Neng peeled the lychee nut of the teachings and popped it in his mouth. And only sweetness was there. And one of the things that I noticed again and again doing the raisin practice was that I didn't even need to chew it. It had been taken care of by my body, the saliva that had risen up in my mouth had already started to dissolve it, and it went down smoothly. This is how the Dharma can be. It can go down smoothly. Not, however, if we resist the teachings of everything. Dogen, in the wonderful piece, the Genjo Koan, that we read portions of earlier during our sutra service, says again and again, in various ways, that we don't need to make a big deal about getting things, getting enlightenment, getting some idea of what we think an enlightened person should be. You know, we don't have to be anything other than ourselves, the one we've been all our lives, that keeps taking different shapes, starting out as a baby and then maturing, and now here we are, some of us quite old. How many decades of life on the planet? And yet, are we not the same people that we were? Or are we? That's one of the biggest questions. It's said in the lore of Zen that there are really only two koans. Who am I and what is it? And this who am I persists and persists and persists as an inquiry which we usually ignore until we start doing Zen practice and hear these teachings of, you know, what's your original face? Huineng asks. And we've taken that little phrase, in this case 23 is full of phrases that are used in Zen teachings elsewhere in the koans and in texts and in writings by people of the way. The original face is one of the things that's derived from this little imagined conversation between Ming and Huineng. What is your original face? Who are you? And beyond good or evil, beyond all ideas of right and wrong, there's a little poem by Rumi that begins, out beyond all ideas of right doing and wrong doing, there is a field. I'll meet you there, Rumi says. I'll meet you there. And here we are, meeting each other in that field. And a lot of us have held on so tightly to ideas of right and wrong, or to the idea that we've let go of right and wrong. All ideas, to meet in the field that's beyond this is quite a delicious thing. It tastes like a lychee nut. It tastes like the inside of a raisin. It tastes like the sweetest thing you've ever encountered. But if you keep persisting on having a strong idea about who you are or what the world is, or you keep seeking ways to figure things out, that will block you. You won't be able to meet in that field. And the sadness of this practice is that it reveals to us, and I'm including myself here, every one of us has our strategies for preventing ourselves from being intimate with the world. Every one of us. And they're different. And they reveal themselves at a sesshin. And sometimes we don't like what we see. Or sometimes we blame other people for pointing them out to us. And sometimes we just say, nah, that's not really me. I'm this kind of a person. All the parts of the self, all the parts of the personality are you. The original face manifests from moment to moment differently, from day to day differently. Yesterday, I think I mentioned in the Dharma dialogue, everything went wrong for me. I couldn't believe it. There was a part of my mind that said, are you kidding me? This too? And then this morning, things changed and things are different, but everything's different. Everything's different than what it was when I first started the talk. Everything is constantly in motion. This original face manifests itself, and it's outside of time and space. David and I had the wonderful experience. We went to a time machine. We got to go back 50 years in time because we had a reunion, a 50th reunion of a musical group that we were in at our old university. And a lot of people came to it who we knew really well 50 years ago. And I got to say that I thought that I had changed. I'm not the person I was 50 years ago. And I thought David had changed and all these people had changed. No one had changed. There was one person I didn't recognize because he looked really old. But then I saw the twinkle in his eye and I saw his smile. It was that same person that I loved so much 50 years ago. The same person. But he'd had all these life experiences. I'd had 50 years of life experiences. It was sobering. There was a lot of stuff about playing in this particular orchestra, which was an orchestra from Java. And I hadn't played Javanese music in 35 years. But it was amazing what came back to me and what didn't come back. There were some parts of my brain that couldn't remember how to do some things, but it didn't matter. There's this kind of orchestra is 30-plus instruments, most of them made out of brass, that all play at the same time. It sounds like, the first time you hear it, just a mess of sound, a wash of sound that doesn't make any sense. And I had learned how to hear it 50 years ago. And when we started playing, I could still hear it. I could hear it again. It was really like going back 50 years in time. Even though I, as some separate self, didn't know exactly what I was doing with my instrument, it didn't matter. It didn't matter. Suddenly, the world was offering itself to me in the form of this music and all the people that I knew so well, that I spent so much time with, almost like coming here to the temple. You know, that so many people have been in this room for so many years, and most of them aren't here, but some of us are here. We've been here all along, and some of us are new, and some of us don't get to come to a sesshin at the temple for a year, or sometimes more than that, and some of us come all the time. And here we are, and here we will always be. No matter what happens in the future, no matter what's happened in the past, the taste of the Dharma is strong and sweet, and we do associate it with places and buildings and smells and people. It never leaves us. Wu Men's last line of this poem is so interesting. When the world is destroyed, it is not destroyed. There's another koan, a famous koan, where somebody asks a teacher, in the great kalpa fire, will everything be destroyed? And the teacher says, yep, everything is going to go. And yet, here's Wu Men saying, nope. Nope. Always here. Always here. This taste. Right now. It's not going anywhere because it never came from anywhere. Our true self, sometimes people call it that, our original face, whatever it is, the little spark of bodhicitta that animates us and animates the universe, that animated you when the original sperm and egg came together in your mother's belly. That animating force has kept you going all these years. It's amazing. And we may think that we do Zen to improve ourselves. Well, you were fine, just fine, when the egg and the sperm got together. And you're just fine now. This is the thing that Hui Neng understood when he heard the quotation from the Diamond Sutra, when he was exploring, when he overheard this monk chanting the Diamond Sutra and he was selling his firewood, and he heard a line that said, abiding nowhere, let the heart mind come forth. And it caught him. It was one of those things. We all get caught by these little phrases, like the lychee nut caught me, or the original face, or whatever might have caught you from this very rich koan that has so many beautiful words. That's what caught him. and it somehow touched his original face, the original spark of life that we call bodhicitta, the energy of practice, the force of practice, the wisdom heart, bodhicitta, that animates the universe, that turns the earth, makes the wind blow and the rain fall and the sun rise, all of it animated by an aliveness. It's called by different names in different cultures and different religions. We call it bodhicitta in Zen. We could also call it qi or ki. This animating force that isn't really ours. We are part of it. It is not destroyed. And to surrender to that, to surrender to it the way that Wei Nung ultimately did, the way that Monk Ming ultimately did. And then, of course, Monk Ming, we love him, don't we? Because he's so much like us. Going, 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 going. I'm going to get this. I'm going to get this. I'm going to come to Sesshin to fill in the blank. And that's not what happens. Whatever you thought was going to happen, it's not like that. We can't, our minds are wonderful and figuring things out and coming up with all kinds of scenarios. How lucky we are to have minds that can do this. We wouldn't have sesshins without minds because we have to plan them and figure things out. We have an officer manual that tells us what to do. And, you know, that's all the product of the mind. But the animating force underneath it is this bodhicitta. And that's the most important thing. And the bodhicitta takes over after a while. You may have noticed it. You're not thinking anymore. Orioki, oh my God, it's so complicated. Maybe not so much anymore. Walking meditation, sitting meditation, working with a koan. For those of you who work with a koan, you think, wow, this doesn't make any sense at all. Please, I don't understand. I'm so overwhelmed. I'm so confused. Oh, that's a no-brainer. I think literally it is a no-brainer. When the brain interferes. I always love the Alan Watts, who was a great writer and practitioner of the way he was treated as a teacher, but he wasn't actually officially a Zen teacher. He also later in his life became a Taoist. And his autobiography is called In My Own Way. And of course, that's got a double meaning, right? He was an iconoclast. He just did whatever he wanted. I don't think he'd be happy at a boundless way session. He just was his own person, in my own way. But the book, if you ever read it, is a very beautiful narrative of how he kept getting in his own way. And I think this is what we do. Our ideas and our sense of who we are and who we want to be, that great longing to be somebody else. I want to be a person who's calmer and never is afraid of anything and can just be, you know, Mrs. Cool and go through life never being bothered by anything. And that is not the Zen way. That is actually, what's the word I want to use here? It's a betrayal of the Zen way. And it's what people in pop culture think is Zen. And maybe a lot of you do too. I wish. I want. And all the time, as Hakuin Zenji says in his Song of Zazen, we've been like people who are thirsty standing in the midst of water. Everything we've ever longed for has always been here. But it hasn't taken the form that our little minds think it should. And that's a sad thing, but it's also a very, very human thing. And I've got to say that I think my fellow teachers would agree with me. One of our biggest jobs, it's twofold. It's to see each person demonstrating their original face all the time, to see the bodhicitta, the little spark of the awakened heart that's present in all of us, that is so clouded over or disguised or encased in a hard shell of a kind of unwillingness to just show up as that soft little lychee nut that we all are. And of course, we probably had experiences where we did show up that way and we got hurt by that. People took advantage of us. People didn't want to join with us in the mushiness of the sweetness of the Buddha nature. So we had to put up these fronts, we had to put up these protections. But here, the way the sesshin is structured, maybe there's a dissolving of those protections. Maybe we don't have to be so cool anymore. Maybe we don't have to have all the theories and memorize all the books and figure out the way to be as a person. Maybe we can be intimate with our lives. Maybe we can know water directly and know whether it's warm or cool. The mind doesn't tell us that. Maybe we can enter our life and even all the regrets we see are parts of the Buddha Dharma, and even these protective shells, sometimes walls, are also part of the Buddha Dharma. It's not our job to destroy them. It's our job to receive the teachings of the universe, which naturally dissolve them. And all we have to do is cooperate by sitting still and being upright and being in silence and doing our best. A simple formula, but not so easy. Not so easy, because we always think we know better. We get in our own way. And of course, Ming's heroic to us because he was totally wrong about what he was doing, and it led him straight to the Dharma. And so we have gotten to be totally wrong for however many decades we've been on the planet, and then often suddenly, sometimes in a big way, sometimes in a little way, the world reveals itself to us. And the clue that this may be an awakening experience is that it really feels nice. It's not scary, it's not terrifying, it's more like, oh, give me another lychee nut, please. But then we get fixated and we want to find lychee nuts all the time. It never ends. The practice never ends with a got it, done, over. Constantly we bring ourselves to meet the world, and the world responds by meeting us. So the big challenge here is, are you willing to do it? To do nothing? To wait and receive what the world's been trying to offer you all your life? That you decided wasn't it, because how could it be it? Because it looks like this, it's supposed to look like this. I read about it, I heard a talk about it, I figured it out for myself. What a relief to just sit and let the world offer itself. The sixth ancestor was pursued by Ming, the head monk, as far as Dayu Peak. The teacher, seeing Ming coming, laid the robe and bowl on a rock and said, "This robe represents the Dharma. There should be no fighting over it. You may take it back with you." Ming tried to lift it up, but it was as immovable as a mountain. Shivering and trembling, he said, "I came for the Dharma, not for the robe. I beg you, lay brother, please open the way for me." The teacher said, "Don't think good, don't think evil. At this very moment, what is the original face of Ming, the head monk?" In that instant, Ming had great satori. Sweat ran from his entire body. In tears, he made his bows, saying, "Besides these secret words and secret meanings, is there anything of further significance?" The teacher said, "What I have just conveyed to you is not secret." And Wu Men says, it must be said that the sixth ancestor forgets himself completely in taking action here. He's like a kindly grandmother who peels a fresh lychee, removes the seed, and puts it in your mouth. Then you only need to swallow it down. And his verse, it can't be described. It can't be pictured. It can't be praised enough. Stop groping for it. The original face has nowhere to hide. When the world is destroyed, it is not destroyed. Thank you. So please make yourselves comfortable and servers come around. So, who's first? It's Ray.
Thank you, Melissa, for your wonderful talk. A lot of wonderful pointers. And this character of Ming resonates with me in a lot of ways. Just recently, my son shared with me that at a musical festival, he took some LSD and had an awakening experience. And, you know, when he spoke about it, everything he said resonated with the truth of what, you know, I longed for. And I became very jealous of his experience. Yeah, maybe I should try LSD or some other shortcut to having the felt experience of what I guess longed for in some way. And so I went into the right and wrong and quickly saw that, you know, his experience was genuine. Then I had to deal with my jealousy, my greed at wanting that for myself. And he doesn't even sit. Here I am, you know, having this chair going, feels like at a snail's pace on this journey. But he's my son, you see, and that's what saved me. I loved him. I loved him. And that love expanded to remembering my bodhisattva vows. Whatever happens to be of service to anyone in their lives, it's good. I got to see where I still held on to me wanting it for myself. And then, yes, the world and my generosity. I could share the world. But that greed, even in, you know, like you were talking about the leech nuts, you know, yes, and I want more. So.
You know, throughout when you were just talking, what really pulled me in was when you said, I love my son. Mm-hmm. That there's no LSD trip that can actually touch that.
Yeah, and just underlining that, we all have our own path. And of course the irony of this is the path is leading back to here. We're not going anywhere. Mm-hmm. So to value your path and your son's path. Thank you. Yeah, Deb.
Thank you so much for the talk. What really spoke to me was this before Sashin, like I'm going to come to Sashin. We have a relative that's hovering between life and death, and it's like, life is short. Really need to use every second of Sashin. I'm going to really... And I felt like me, this is like me struggling with that rock, and finally, oh, let go of the rock. And, you know, just be with what is. And, like, it's like, it came to me, like, be real with what is right now. With the dead koi in the pond, with the, you know, with the... I peel these eggs for the snack table, and it's been a practice.
Yeah, I think, Deb, you're talking about letting go. So wonderful intentions, so wonderful. Yeah, we see someone close to us, and we realize our time is short, and indeed it is. We form this great resolve. Okay, now, and then that resolve comes and goes, and that resolve then can get in the way. Well, I'm going to hold on to. I'm going to, because it's not about working hard, is it? Right. It is about some clear intention. It is about coming back, but you can't force your way into. Into this moment because you're already there, right? And so I guess we're always, I think all of us get inspired and let's work hard, let's really hold ourselves accountable, work in that way, and then we exhaust ourselves and we wear ourselves out and then we just have to sit and go, oh, this is okay. Maybe this is what I'm supposed to be doing. Right, and then that can be flat. Right? Okay, yeah. Well, it's just the eggs. Got to peel another egg. we get lost in that. But through all this, this intention finds us. Truly, I think we do not find it, but we allow ourselves to be found again and again. And this egg.
Yeah,
Anne. Yeah, I loved your story, Ray. Thank you. But I've also thought, what if it wasn't your son? I mean, I'm thrilled when someone I'm close to has something wonderful happen to them. But what if it's someone I'm not close to, or someone I even sort of actively dislike? I mean, how far... Someone close to is still part of me. I can see them. Someone I like is part of me. Someone I dislike, I go, well... And I don't think I can let go of that greed for someone who's totally disconnected from me. I can try, but I'm not very good at it.
Well, you know, what was great about Ray's story was many things. But we have to be careful to not expect a similar outcome to what happened to Ray. His first step was to open to that feeling of jealousy.
Yeah.
And that's where the practice is. Then whatever happens, it could be that he's still going to be jealous of his son, even though his son is him. Or it's a very important practice in Buddhism. And Dogen talks about it, to study the ways, to study the self, period. Mm-hmm. Right? We have to start there. If we leap away from it, and Dogen's really clear, don't do that. You know, there's emptiness, there's form, there's no form, no emptiness, and then flowers fall though we love them. Weeds grow though we hate them. This is, we have to keep being with what really is happening. And so, you know, I struggle every time I get one of those Buddhist magazines in the mail. I think, oh, why them and not me? And I know them, and they're not like that. And, you know, and I have to kind of go through that. I think it's natural. These feelings of jealousy, they're not to be excised and thrown on the fire and burned up. There's something rich inside them. And I think what I heard from Ray's story was a recognition, oh, right, I love this person. And who cares whether he had an enlightenment experience or not? So you don't know. And it could be, oh, I really don't like this person. And to own that, right, own it all in the sense of, Let me look and see. I think that was one of the Buddha's primary instructions. He said to his disciples, look and see, or come and see. And that's what we're doing, studying the self, even though we don't know what it is.
Yeah. And there's this human thing we do of comparing our insides to other people's outsides. I had someone after a retreat come up to me many, many years ago, and she said, how was it? And I said, how was what? And she said, your big awakening experience. And I said, I didn't even know I had one. But she was certain that I had tasted the Kool-Aid and that I had something, and she was living in that world. But I think one of the themes we've been talking about here, that nothing is the end. Right, so big experience, all right, now what? Right, little experience, no experience. Now what is the question? These openings, if you have a large opening, and some people do, you're in real trouble, right? And I have seen many people who have had deep insight and gone on to very, very difficult karma and life. It has not been, oh, I finally see it, and now my life is smooth. There is not that place. And so in that way, nobody has anything you don't already have. And what you have is this moment, and what is this, and this next step. And this is so precious and wonderful, and we can begin to appreciate that. And I love this. The entry point is not to get better and try to be have less feelings, but how do I enter with these? Maybe I feel a joy in the joy of others. Maybe I feel jealousy. Why not me? How do I do it? Well, right here is how you do it.
Thank you. Thanks. Yeah, Will?
I'm wondering about the last thing that Wei Nan says to maintain that realization and guard it carefully.
Mm-hmm.
I guess it's not my business, but I wonder what he means.
No, it actually is your business. I think it really is. Do you remember the
phrase? It's Zenji Goji. Fully treasure, fully yourself, treasure and stand by. Fully yourself, treasure and stand by. I think the guard makes, I got to defend this, but I think stand by, rely on, come back to, live in alignment with, treasure yourself fully.
Maintain sounds like a motorcycle.
Yeah, exactly.
But there is some maintenance required, right?
The oil, aside from the oil changes.
You know that book. But it is true. I think, all these different words are pointing to something.
Hmm.
It's one of the things about taking psychedelics is that those experiences do fade. And, of course, awakening experiences fade too. Just ordinary non-drug experiences also fade. But there's something that shifts. There's a line in the Lankavatara Sutra that says, just trying to describe awakening as a deep shift at the base of the body or something, at the base of the, right, that there's some turning about at the base. Once that thing gets turned about, then there's more and more opportunity for the world to reveal itself in certain ways. But you have to keep working. It's so easy to concretize any awakening. And then what you've done is, not only have you, do we have our personalities that are rigidified and into preventing the world from getting in, but also we conscript awakening into that. Right, everybody does it that I know, and then that has to be softened up again and over and over. So it's a a lifelong process. I think that's what we're talking about. But I also just quick anecdote about Ram Dass. Some of you may know who he was. He was Richard Alpert. He was a professor at Harvard who worked with Timothy Leary, and they, you know, they took a lot of psychedelics. And then he went to India and met this guru, and I'm spacing on the guru's name right now, if anybody knows it. Anyway, he so the guru was really interested in the psychedelic stuff that he was doing, and he said, "Can I try some?" So Ram Dass got some acid for him, and he took it, and nothing happened. And he said, "I don't get it. What's the big deal?" Because he had been living his whole life in this practice of intimacy, so he didn't need any door to open for him. It was open. And this, I've noticed this a lot, with, and so this may be reassuring for some of you, that people who practice a lot for years and years and years and years and keep thinking, "I'm not having awakening experience." Well, I can see that you are, but that it doesn't fit your criteria. So I'm just waiting. And then they're gentler. They're like, you know, that most people who get on, this is a big generalization, don't have these, "Oh my God, oh wow, I see everything, I see the universe." Because it's been like that flower, right, opening and blossoming. And and so we can't ever, so not only can we not, do we compare our insides to other people's outsides, we also can never judge our own practice. We don't know what's going on. We think we do, and we make up stories about it. And that's dangerous. I really do feel like it's dangerous.
And just to add, the only relationship you can have to your awakening or to your Kensho or to your acid trip is the one you have right now. And so if you're not here now, it's just a concept, an idea that's just
thought. Exactly. Thank you. Yeah, Seth?
I you brought in this concept of expressing bodhicitta.
Can you speak up a little bit? We can't hear you.
I use the microphone.
Yeah, right.
Use your microphone.
Expressing bodhicitta. At least for my practice, I feel like expression is such a big part of what Zen practice is like to me. But although we don't say that word that often. Like sometimes we talk about this beautiful choreography, and then always says, "Oh, but you know, we're not here to do like a play or performance. Not art to be beautiful," but the art idea really speaks a lot to me in that, you know, we're not doing all this serving stuff to make it look pretty for the cameras. It's a way of expressing, you know, when we eat, we're expressing how we're eating. When we're angry, you express anger. You know, if somebody's painting something and you're like, "Why is that red?" They don't give you a long, they just say, "I want it to be red, it's red." You know, "Why'd you make a mistake?" "I made a mistake." Like this line from Dogen, the flowers fall even though we love them, the weeds grow even though we hate them. For me, I always hear, you know, "Even though we love them, we hate them. It's kind of absurd about having all these feelings. It's almost like, sorry, just last thing, but I for a while did a lot of interviewing over Zoom, and one of our processes was we would type down everything that they said so we can look at it later. And we'd coach people, we'd say, "Don't try to figure out what you think, just write it down, just write it down." There is some of that sense for me of, like on Sesshin, just write it down, don't try to interpret it, transcribe what's going on and see what's, you know, anyway,
Yeah, I appreciate you talking about this expressive quality of our practice here on Sesshin. And one of the ways to think about that is the bodies of Buddha. So Dharmakaya, Sambhogakaya, Nirmanakaya. Dharmakaya, the source world, no words, nothing can be said. Sambhogakaya, the appreciation, the bliss body, the dreams, the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas fill the universe. And the Nirmanakaya is walking in step. Is the three servers carry the oatmeal pots out of the zendo together in front of the Buddha. And sitting in our zazen posture is an expression of our love. right? Our great love for this mysterious world. And so we are not sitting to ourselves or by ourselves. There's no audience, as you say. It's not, well, that's a 4.2. but there is something that we can touch and can express in each breath, and nothing more needs to be done from that. But it is an energetic quality. So our practice is not just internal. So we're not sitting shrinking, but all of us filling up our whole space as the fish and the bird do. We fill up the whole space seated on our cushion, whole universe, and as we walk and as we do all of these things. So I love you bringing that up.
Perfect. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, I think maybe just one or two more. I saw a couple of hands. Yep, so we'll do Rich and Laura. We'll start with Rich.
So I shared a little bit of this during the residency when Alan gave a Dharma talk about his early journey, which sparked the whole discussion. But I did the S training when I was in the early 70s, and I actually did it with my therapist at the time, who introduced me to Zen. And it was like the best thing I'd ever done in it. I was just so connected. I understood everything, and I was in my mid-20s. And within a few weeks or a month, I crashed and burned, and I recovered from it, obviously. But, and what I didn't have, I didn't have a practice then.
Exactly.
And I didn't have a teacher or teachings.
Yeah.
But that's still with me. I mean, that it still haunts me.
Right.
If I let go, I brought down like a little tenants organization that I was part of, and I just did some weird stuff, that it fucking never goes away.
Right.
You know?
Right.
It's just,
right. Yeah. These. Thank you.
Yeah.
These experiences. Some of them resonate differently than others, and some of them really do persist in this way that's, I wouldn't say it's positive or negative, but just to be awake to, oh, look, here it is. And crashing and burning is part of what can happen, especially in unsupported practice. That's why we have teachers and Doksan, that's why we have the structures of Sesshin. Because I've been to things like that where just the expectation is that you're supposed to melt into a puddle on the floor, and then a small percentage of people in those things then go off to the institution. And so we're not aiming for that. That's why I said, a true awakening has this kind of sweet pleasure about it.
Right.
Not like, wow, but,
I mean, there was an opening.
Of course. But then to maintain it, right? To go back to the motorcycle, your awakening didn't get maintained. It ran out of oil, of something.
Right.
And that metaphor is going
to
crash and burn.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, and last, Laura.
So it's just kind of like an inquiry and contemplation that I've been having as I tore my ACL a while ago, and I got a cadaver part put in here, and it's this part that is like allowing me to kneel and to serve, and it's been like touching me so much to think of like how I really would never have known what's like good or bad, or when I fell in the mountain and I tore my ACL, or this person that's like literally allowing me to do all of this, and it's like, I mean, it's just, it really is like blowing my mind to think of like, who am I? And then it's like patchwork. That's also just moving through the world. But I think I've just been really touched by, I guess, the expansiveness of that, and just like how much it fits here. And it just, I feel like a patchwork quote with everyone here too, which is,
And we might say each one of us a patchwork of our whole life. Parents, friends, people we liked, people we didn't like, what happened, what didn't happen, and how astonishing that it's also physical, not just some idea. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we do. We are interdependent, truly, and not separate. Right, we're each one of us part of this vast, swirling wonder.
Thank you, and thanks to everybody. Let's put the zendo back together and come back to our seated posture.